Next is a meeting with disciples on July 25th, 1992 in Wicklow, Ireland.
Near the temple. So I have quite a few questions and answers. But I wanted to first tell you a little bit what I've been doing here in Wicklow. Mostly to tell you about I'm preparing for a seminar that I'm going to teach as part of the Vaishnava Institute for Higher Education in Vrindavan. And so there are many courses that are taught there. And each course is about 22 classes. So to teach a course like that just takes some preparation. Last year I taught a course on reading the Krishna book. And on and off I prepared for that for a couple of years. So last year Burijan suggested I teach about Prabhupada's life. It sounded nice idea. And while I was there I outlined possible ways to divide up the times in Prabhupada's life as it is told in the Prabhupada Lilamrita. And I gave that to a devotee there named Navadweep Das and asked him to gave him some guidelines and asked him to make a course outline for me. So he's been doing that, and I haven't received most of it. But I've been working on my end. On one hand, one could say, well, why do you need to prepare? You already wrote the biography, and you should know these things. Yes. Not only I know them, but everybody knows the stories of Prabhupada, so that's it's kind of like with the Krishna book. At least, it's an anxiety I often go through to teach something that people already know. I think, how am I going to make this interesting? I have to go to a deeper level, and or deeper really means I have to become enthusiastic and not find the material just the same old thing. And then if I feel enthusiastic, then there's a good chance the people in the class will also. So it had been many years since I'd read the Prabhupada Lilamrita, so that was one of my, that's what I'm doing here. Reading, and as I read, taking notes, picking out some anecdotes that seem particularly interesting, and trying to think about them. Think of questions to ask the class and so on. I thought I would, just in that mood, look at a couple of anecdotes actually told by people who we interviewed who had met Prabhupada or been with him. Ones that I've always liked especially. One is from a man who only met Prabhupada once. And he was a reporter in New York City for the Village Voice. And it was the Greenwich Village newspaper. So he said that, I guess reporters are always looking for some story, and they have contacts, tell them that something is interesting happening in the city. So he said some contact of his told him, and what he told him was interesting. He always wondered, who is this contact? He seems very perceptive. He said that there's an interesting holy man from India living in a loft in the Bowery, and you can go there anytime. He's always there. I think you'll find it fascinating. I believe he's about to start a major religious movement. So this Howard Smith went there, and he says when he went into the Bowery loft, and there were old carpets all over the place. Loft means a big area, so there was a big area with carpets, and there were people sitting around in different places, doing different kinds of whatever it was, meditations or prayers or yoga, asanas. Everyone was doing something different, and and none of them gave him any attention to speak to find out where was the Swami. So on his own, he walked around. He didn't know whether he was supposed to take his shoes off. Most of the people had their shoes off. Nobody paid him any attention. And he didn't want to interrupt anybody. They were all in some kind of meditation or drug state or whatever. Then he said he noticed in the back of the loft there was a little curtain there hanging. So he decided to look in there. He looked in, and there was Swami Bhaktivedanta, sitting cross-legged in saffron garments, with the markings on his forehead and nose, and his hand in the bead bag. So there weren't too many people who tell us things from those early days at the Bowery loft, except when they would go to a kirtan or something. But here we get a rare picture of what it was like during the day, or other times that people probably came by, and not so much under Prabhupada's supervision, would just use the place for their own style of spiritual practice, and Prabhupada really couldn't handle them or guide them, but neither did he chase them out. This is what the reporter walked on into. So he sees Prabhupada sitting there, apart from all this. Even though he looked like the real thing, he seemed more approachable. And I said, "Hello." And he looked up. I said, "Swami Bhaktivedanta?" He said, "Yes." I said, "I'm Howard Smith." I was expecting to sit down, so I said, "Excuse me, I have to take off my shoes." He said, "Why do you want to take off your shoes?" I said, "I don't know. I saw all the shoes out there." So Prabhupada told him, "You didn't have to take your shoes off." And then he says, "What are all those people out there doing?" Prabhupada said, "I don't know." "And they don't know what they're doing. I'm trying to teach them, but they misunderstand me. They're very confused." Then we sat and talked, and I liked him a lot right away. So people like pure devotee for different reasons. You'll see this man's impressions, and although his impressions, he's not a seeker looking for spiritual truth, looking for a guru, he's just looking for a story. But I think devotees find his impressions very likable to us, because it shows how Prabhupada is so attractive to any person, and we just wish more people would have these impressions. And appreciated him on these levels. I liked him a lot right away. I mean, I'd met a lot of other Swamis and I didn't like them too much. I don't think it's fair to lump them all together and say those Swamis in India. He was very, very basic, and that's what I seemed to like about him. He not only made me feel at ease, but he seemed very open and honest. Like, he asked my advice on things. He was very new in the country. I thought his ideas stood a good chance of taking hold because he seemed so practical. His head didn't seem in the clouds. He wasn't talking mysticism every third word. I guess that was where his soul was at, but that isn't where his normal conversational consciousness was at. So sometimes sadhus or people who have a reputation of being holy people, they can become pretentious and want to show that I'm very different, I'm thinking of elevated things. You know, they even do it just to attract people. So like that, that Prabhupada was right there with him. That expression, another nice expression, was used by a person in San Francisco who was involved. He was a famous person for putting on light shows at concerts and things. And he was he did the lighting for their mantra rock dance that Prabhupada went to. So he met Prabhupada in his interview. He said it must have been strange for Swami Bhaktivedanta to be amidst all the kind of people that were there in California. He was so different. He said, but he was right there with us. So Prabhupada wasn't afraid to not only to physically be there, but he didn't think I had to protect myself or reserve myself and be very different. He could just be wherever they were at, down to earth. So this man not only likes that Prabhupada is accessible, but he also seems to think that I know he's much deeper than that, but he was also able at the same time to have normal contact and behave like a normal person. He said several people had told him that The Voice would be a very good place to be written up, etc. He asked me if I'd read any books. We talked a little. He wanted to translate his books. Then he handed some books to me and said, if you want more background, you can read these. It was obvious to me that I was not talking to some fellow who had just decided that he had seen God and was going to tell people about it. He seemed to be an educated man, much more than myself, actually, and I liked his humbleness. I just plain liked the guy. Very honest feeling from the heart. I liked him. Then another anecdote. This is similar in that that anecdote was strong on the impressions of the person himself, but we hear Prabhupada through that person. This is a memory of Prabhupada by Hari Vilas. He's now Hari Vilas, who's at GBC and lives in California. At that time, this is 1971, there was the beginning of a temple in Paris, and he was the temple president. The background here is that Prabhupada had just been in Moscow, and that's a fantastic adventure, and had flown from Moscow to Paris, was staying only a couple of days, and then was going all the way in one flight from Paris to Los Angeles. It was like at the height of Prabhupada's world travels. So he stopped in Paris, and he was taken right away to the Indian tourist office in Paris, which has a conference room, and there he was going to meet with some reporters and with devotees. So the devotees were all outside the room at first. There's also a memoir by another devotee, Yogeshwar, who had never seen his spiritual master, although he'd been initiated for a year and a half, and he was waiting so eagerly outside the door. And then Prabhupada looked outside, and there were many devotees out there, and he gestured that they could come in. Yogeshwar, remembering that, says, he responded to Shyamasundara's question, which was, shall I let the devotees in? By motioning with his hand that we could all come in. It was the first perfect thing I'd ever seen in my life, that one gesture, Yogeshwar says. So they all come in. And then all the devotees gather, maybe as many devotees as are here. Picture you get of the room full of devotees. And here's Hari Vilas's story. I arrived late, and when I came in, I was mixed up with surprise, elation, and egotistical pride, with amazement that the Lord's pure devotee was there. I walked in with Ghanisham, the boy who had started translating some of Prabhupada's books into French. The room was almost filled, and Ghanisham immediately sat down in the back. I was the president of the temple, and I was very proud and puffed up about it. So I made my way all the way up to the front, where Srila Prabhupada was, and I sat down right next to him. I looked at him expecting him to look at me and smile or something, some recognition, but he didn't look at me at all. Lochanananda was introducing all the devotees to Prabhupada. Lochanananda said, this is Ghanisham, he is the translator. Prabhupada said, oh, where is he? And everyone looked around to Ghanisham in the back. Prabhupada said, let him stand up, please. Ghanisham stood and Prabhupada looked at him and smiled, said, oh, thank you very much. Right then I felt a little funny. I sat there wondering, what have I done? I've walked all the way up to the front, and I'm expecting so much recognition. Then Lochinanda said, This is Hari Vilas. He is the president of the temple. Prabhupada didn't even look at me. And I knew, yes, I had made a big mistake. I began to realize, this is my spiritual master. Because immediately he had acted in such a way as to point out a great fault in me. Took it very nicely. The guru is always instructing us. So many nice stories. So I hope in this seminar we'll talk about them and talk about the meaning of different things about Prabhupada's life. Also, I was told that it's in mid-August that the book that I wrote last time I was here, which is called Here is Srila Prabhupada, but it's kind of reflections on Prabhupada, but in a different way than Prabhupada meditation, that will be published. I think devotees in Ireland will find it particularly interesting. Because I even have a meditation that of Prabhupada coming to Ireland. In case I don't answer some questions that people have handed in, I'll try to answer them in correspondence. So here's the first question I'm going to handle. Sometimes I doubt whether my activities are devotional service, although mixed devotional service, or are they just ordinary mundane activities motivated by what I want to do, and then I fool myself into believing they are Krishna conscious. It seems that we can be fully engaged in the occupational duties of a grihastha, raising a family, earning a living, etc. And these very duties can either be Maya or Krishna conscious, depending on our motivation. What makes our motivation Krishna conscious? Is it our chanting and our hearing and chanting? I'm going to start answering this, although it develops on into two more questions that I've separated with attempts to answer them in between. So, to begin to answer this, I think we have to, according to the Krishna conscious philosophy, make a distinction between karmic activities and devotional service. We want to know whether what we're doing is devotional service. Even before we consider karmic activities, there are what we call vikarmic. Vikarma means things that are forbidden in the scriptures, sinful things, like eating meat and illicit sex and so on, stealing. So if we do those activities, then nobody can entertain the idea that, yes, I'm doing devotional service. We have to be acquainted with what are different activities, how they understood according to the scriptures. So then karma, or karmic activities, is different than that. There would mostly be to actually earn that name karmic rather than vikarmic. One does things that are not forbidden by the scriptures, and that means follows to some degree pious life, moral life, as taught in all scriptures. And in our Krishna conscious scriptures also. But it doesn't make an offering of the activities to Krishna. So it's not service to Krishna, it's not offered to Krishna. So that, he uses the word, is the difference one of motivation. So that motivation of just trying to please myself or my family. Or Prabhupada says you can extend the selfishness even to help some other community, or my community, without directly serving Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That makes it not devotional service, but karmic activity. With the result, then one may say, well, what is all this splitting hairs, this kind of activity or that kind of activity? Oh, it's very crucial, because the result is karmic activities means that in the next life, you will be certain to come back and have to fulfill all these different reactions that you've developed by your activities. There's no question of liberation from karmic activities, good or bad. And even more important than that for the devotee, he has no loving life, and no knowledge of his relationship with his best friend, with Krishna. I wanted to look at the scriptures for this. I think I read this same verse maybe last week from the first canto. Dharmak sunasti tat pumsam vishpakshina katasuya nat poriyad yarivatim shrama evi kevalam. The occupational activities a man performs according to his own position are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead. So this is partly answering the answer given by the questioner. He said, is the difference between karmic activities and my family life, or rather say, is the difference between a karmic family life and a devotee family life, that the devotee is chanting and hearing? So that's certainly a very important distinction. Because here it says that the work that you do, it should provoke attraction to the message of Krishna. Then Prabhupada says, therefore we have to engage ourselves in occupational engagements that will evoke our divine consciousness. This is possible only by hearing and chanting the divine activities of the Supreme Lord. And any occupational activity which does not help one to achieve attachment for hearing and chanting the transcendental message of Godhead is said to be simply a waste of time. So not only do we have to find time to chant and hear about Krishna, but according to this, the work itself should help us to develop that attachment. There's a very nice picture in the Bhagavad Gita, in a purport, of what Grihastha life is like when it's done as devotional service, what the routine is of the family. So although these activities are going on, money-making and all the other things that have to do with running a household, the household should be centered in on Krishna. So there's a routine to do that. This is in chapter 13, texts 8 through 12, where different items are described of knowledge. And a person who is knowledgeable, one of the items is that he's freedom from entanglement with children, wife, home, and the rest. So now Prabhupada explains what that means. As for detachment from children, wife, and home, it is not meant that one should have no feeling for these. They are natural objects of affection. But when they are not favorable to spiritual progress, then one should not be attached to them. The best process for making the home pleasant is Krishna consciousness. If one is in full Krishna consciousness, he can make his home very happy, because this process of Krishna consciousness is very easy. One need only chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Accept the remnants of foodstuff offered to Krishna, have some discussion on books like Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and engage oneself in deity worship. These four things will make one happy. One should train the members of his family in this way. The family members can sit down morning and evening and chant together, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. If one can mold his family life in this way to develop Krishna consciousness, following these four principles, there is no need to change from family life to renounced life. There's a very direct advice about how to conduct chanting and hearing in the family. So now, going on with the same train of inquiry, same person said, asked, having said, is the difference that one that we're just that we're chanting and hearing, we add that to our life, that makes it devotional service? Now this that point is inquired further. We're told simply by hearing we can purify our activities. Does this mean that our hearing about Krishna has a mystical effect, and so everything we do becomes purified? Or is it that when we read, it's supposed to force us to admit our rascaldom and then inspire us to work diligently to become pure? Yes, the reading has a mystical effect, but that doesn't mean that something happens that you don't know what it is. But you can perceive what happens by chanting and hearing. It's also mentioned in Bhagavad Gita as a characteristic of Raja Vidya, that you can directly perceive it. And you become attracted to Krishna consciousness, and you become inclined to serve Krishna. To do those very things that you want to do, those very things that you have to do as devotional service. So even that anxiety that how is this educating the children Krishna conscious? How is making money Krishna conscious? That's a good beginning to desire this link and to feel dissatisfied. It may be that you don't have the link established or not well enough. We're always thinking that our devotional service is not good enough. There should be some anxiety. But no one will, a karmi won't have that anxiety. He just wants, his only anxiety is how to get more sense gratification and money or leisure, or whatever. But the devotee grihastha, is thinking, how can I link up all these activities in the service of Krishna? You see, I have some quote about that. So this should be provoked, or this should come by chanting and hearing. In addition to the act itself, one wants to do that more and more with the family and feels purified and wants to transform all the activities, other activities, from ordinary to bhakti. So Krishna says, or through the Bhagavatam, Atak pumbir dvija shreshta shvarna ashrama vibhagasa svanusthitasya dharmasya samsidhir haritosanam. It is concluded that the highest perfection one can achieve by discharging the duties prescribed for one's own occupation, according to caste divisions and orders of life, is to please the personality of Godhead. And Prabhupada repeats that in the purport. Each and every one of the above mentioned divisions of life, the aim must be to please the supreme authority of the personality of Godhead. That's the function of Varnashram Dharma. Varnashram Dharma doesn't mean just to be well situated in psychophysical work, but through that work that is suited for you to please Krishna, and then you'll feel pleased also. That will satisfy you. So the actual activity of Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, that can never be exaggerated as to its importance, but in addition to it, you have to find ways to dovetail all activities. Whatever you have, you have. So as a grihastha, you generate some wealth. Then the children are a kind of asset or liability, but there a great deal of energy is going into child rearing. And then there's a wife for the husband, and for the wife there's a husband. So all these realities, they have to be engaged in a way that's pleasing to Krishna. My relationship with my wife is pleasing to Krishna. My activities with my children, like that, and my wealth is used somehow in the service of Krishna. Not just that I chant and hear and everything else, there's no effort to dovetail the other things. The suggestion that will the chanting inspire us to work diligently to become pure? We have to work diligently, but not just hard work itself, that doesn't purify us. That I'm not a lazy man, I work hard. But I have to work hard in a way that's pleasing to Krishna. Work hard at that, at dovetailing. And then, going on with this questioning, I suppose the insecurity is there, insecurity of whether as a grihastha I'm really serving Krishna or not, is there because living in the temple we were always told to do the needful, so we felt that it was devotional service. Whereas as a grihastha, we may also do the needful, but it appears to be less Krishna conscious due to it being more selfishly oriented. Is this a misconception? So living in the temple, we were doing direct missionary work or preaching activities. So whatever the needful was, by its very nature, it was for the good of all humanity. Now, of course, you can bring up the point that in temple life, there is certainly imperfection of so many kinds. And this may not be the actual consciousness in a temple. But I would leave that aside, that issue aside. The temple is supposed to be a place where it's a fact. Whatever you do there, as Prabhupada said, if you sweep the floor or you turn a screw in construction, it's all connected directly to spreading Krishna consciousness, because that's what the temple is for. It doesn't have another purpose. Maintaining devotees, inviting people, and from that place, spreading Krishna consciousness. And we did, we had that faith, those who lived in the temple and don't now. And this is what's being expressed here. Not a resentment of temple life, but rather a feeling that I was engaged then in a surrendered consciousness because I had faith that everything was being done for God and for giving God consciousness to humanity. But when I look around at my griha, I'm not secure whether I'm on that level. So my needful, or what I have needful means, do what you have to do. Do the necessary. So the grihastha should see his needful not as materialistic, but as what I've referred to already. To see the wife as the servant of Krishna and the children, then it's like a little temple. And whatever was ideal in that surrendered service that you did, that enthusiastic service, to join the temple, give everything up, it can be transferred to this other little temple, and which is contained in the word grihastha. There is a very elevated concept. To the degree that this kind of service is less potent than needful acts in temple life, then a grihastha is meant to compensate for this by charity, by his own personal sadhana. He may be in a situation where it's not as intensely surrendered that he feels. Then he can make it intense or purify it by these are the typical acts of in Vedic culture for the grihastha, to give charity. And then himself, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, to perform such exemplary sadhana that his whole family is inspired, and then to participate still in the preaching mission. Although I don't live in the temple, there are persons who are fully engaged in conducting the preaching activities. I can still participate, certainly, and they want me to participate. Like Prabhupada did as a grihastha in Allahabad when it was convenient for him, and he lived near the temple. He used to regularly go there, play the madranga, bring his friends who would donate, and he would give lectures and so on, participate. It, to offset any tendency that is there, that maintenance of family life doesn't have a vital connection to Krishna. I'm not saying that has to happen, but if it does, these are some ways to compensate for it. I can go on to other topics, but if there's some questions about this, we can discuss. Yeah.
It was kind of tied into, I think, the first week when we were here, and Tulsi Priya was talking about doing an activity that you like, or doing something that maybe you have to do that you don't like. And there is this kind of concept that if someone is running, say, a devotee restaurant, and they're making their living from that, that externally at least it's more kind of Krishna conscious, if you like, than say selling paintings, because you're distributing prasadam. And then that question talked about like the motivation behind it. And then I was reading the other day in when Lord Krishna enters Dwarka that the prostitutes were glorifying him when he was entering, and Prabhupada said in the purport that this example shows that nobody has to change their occupation, even as a prostitute, because it's a necessary occupation in society, that one can become a pure devotee in an occupation. So Prabhupada, in that first quote that you read, you said that as well as reading and chanting, your work also should, it's good if your work is also helping you develop. But it would seem that certain occupations don't really do that.
Yeah.
But then in that purport, Prabhupada seems to sort of say that doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
No matter what you do, then you can
Yeah.
So it seems like there's a kind of a paradox.
Somehow or other, we have to save ourselves. That's like the bottom line of the most important thing, to save yourself, meaning don't get yourself in a position where you can't practice Krishna consciousness. So it would be an individual thing. Prabhupada, in that purport that you referred to, he's saying that it's possible no matter what you do, you can be serving Krishna if you have the right mentality. You don't have to change your occupation. But someone might say that I think that this job I have is just completely killing my spirit and I can't practice Krishna consciousness. So then, if we just quote that to them, it's not going to help them. So then we would try to think, well, do you have to do this for your spiritual life? Is there something that you could do that would be better? And if there isn't, then they have to somehow turn that into surrender to Krishna by patience and tolerance. But we should do what, give ourselves a chance to do something that is favorable, that does promote devotional attitude. And often we hear that. Someone will say, oh, now I've changed, my situation has changed and it's much better, now I have time to read, or it was so hellish before. So why not, as we try to improve different things, try to improve that. Like in America, Americans have a reputation for being very mobile within their country. They're always moving somewhere else, they think it'll be better, or get a new job. And it's not considered wrong to always be moving around and looking for something. It's all for sense gratification, a better situation. But with that same attitude of not being satisfied, one can try to make adjustments to get a better job for a devotee, which would mean different things than it might for a karmi. But if that's not to be done, then you have to take the other attitude. Then you get into sociological or communal development of a religion like ISKCON, and how when the members of the religion get together, they can help each other in that way, like, so that you can work in a devotional atmosphere or at something that is more Krishna conscious than another type of work, devotee businesses or something like that, where the workplace or the hours or even the product has got some nice devotional connection. In the absence of that, we make our own way.
Those prostitutes in the Bhagavatam, would they be in a position where there's just no possibility of them engaging
with that kind of occupation? It's a little obscure to us that society where the prostitutes are where it's mentioned as not being something that has to be banned by the government or something. But certainly, it's an abominable profession, and you know, if a person came to Prabhupada and was practicing that, he would tell them, "Oh, you must give this up. No illicit sex." Can't quote that passage. you know, the idea is that as bad as that is, it's not as bad as a man going to a respectable girl, another man's wife, and fulfilling his lusty desires that way. But it's still not an approved way of life.
But the work, performing your work and your sadhana and everything, like example, when he landed to Prabhupada's father, coming back and he's offering arti, Prabhupada's little boy, and he sees his father, seemingly mundane work, he was selling cloth or whatever, and Prabhupada said this is his real business.
Yeah, that seemed to be, when you think of that Gormohan day, his work didn't seem to be so religious, selling cloth, but he had like an internal life of his deity worship and his thoughts of Krishna, deep cultural Vaishnava upbringing, that maybe we can't really imagine even. So in a case like that, when one does one's duty and can be very Krishna conscious and religious, yeah, even the work is not considered the all in all. And one accepts these things. I heard Prabhupada on a tape talking about how in India the people accept things as karma. And if they're poor, they don't worry about it. They don't even try to figure out why they're poor. They just say God has arranged it this way, and they live simply and practice Krishna consciousness. So that with that attitude, one would accept that he's a grihastha and would accept that he has some occupation, whatever it is, and would do it without perhaps straining as much as I'm talking about to have a devotee kind of job and to keep your consciousness up. They would just be able to do it by being trained as devotees or by having devotion to Krishna. This is what I do. But I'm always thinking of Krishna and trying to offer my services to Krishna. Whether I'm a doctor, think of Lord Chaitanya's grihastha followers. Professions represented were physician, seller of banana leaves, so many different things that in themselves weren't a quote devotee business. But the banana leaf seller, half of the money he used to worship Ganges, and the doctor physician, when he saw a peacock fan, he fainted when he was tending the king. So that's the high consciousness they had. Yes?
It would just seem that it's actually more important, that internal thing, than the job you do. Because it may be doing something that somewhat like I did that, like say running a devotee restaurant, but it can kind of lull you into kind of a false sense of security or doing something and forget about the kind of motivation in terms of.
They're crying out to Krishna at every minute to please protect me and please accept my offering. That's the internal mood of a worker. Right. Since we're talking a lot about chanting and hearing, the question comes up how to develop a taste for it. There's a nice statement by Prabhupada on it. By serving those devotees, this is the verse, Shushrusho Shradhanasya Vasudeva Katha Ruchi. By serving those devotees who are completely freed from all vice, great service is done. By such service, one gains affinity for hearing the messages of Vasudeva. The Prabhupada says that the Lord declares that no one is dearer to him than one who risks everything to preach his glory. By serving the servants of the Lord, one gradually gets the qualities of such servants, and thus one becomes qualified to hear the glories of the Lord. The eagerness to hear about God is the first qualification of a devotee eligible for entering the kingdom of God. The Lord is present in sound vibration, but we don't have a taste. We have already discussed developing a taste for hearing and chanting the holy sound. It is done through the medium of service to the pure devotee of the Lord. And after this comes the verse, by regular attendance in classes of the Bhagavatam and rendering service to the pure devotee. So the message here is by service to the pure devotee. And speaking of mystical effects, a mystical effect or something that cannot be ordinarily understood happens. Prabhupada says, by pleasing the devotee Bhagavata, one can receive the benefit of the book Bhagavata. Human reason fails to understand how by serving the devotee Bhagavata or the book one gets gradual promotion on the path of devotion. But actually, these facts are explained. So we can... If we neglect this, if we just have a program to try to read and chant, but we don't render service, to the Vaishnava, then that won't be evoked very easily or quickly. We hear a lot about being where we are at, or acting on our real platform, or not being artificial. How can we know where we are at? And it goes on to more questions that are similar. Should we listen to others' opinions of us? Sometimes it is difficult to be honest about ourselves or really see ourselves, our anarthas, etc. How to do this effectively so we can change for the better? I've discussed this from different angles in Truthfulness, the Last Leg of Religion, especially in the seventh chapter about, it's called the Honesty, the Good Fight. this attitude of being natural or being real, that's of course important, not being artificial, but I make the point that that should not be an excuse for not striving in devotional service. They say, well, some people are false, and they may present themselves as spiritually advanced. But I'm just honest. I don't have a taste for chanting and hearing, and I don't feel like I want to advance, and so on. And in that way, condone your own lazy activities or not trying to practice Krishna consciousness wholeheartedly. So that's not a really good kind of honesty. Although it may be a beginning. So, as far as being able to actually see what's wrong with us and how we can advance, piercing the facade that we've developed, that takes a kind of discipline or way of life of just trying to be honest. It's not so much a trick or a technique, but it's a resolution that a person develops deeply, that I want to be honest. It's a very important thing for me. Honesty is vitally connected to spiritual life. One can practice spiritual activities and be a hypocrite by showing himself to be religious but actually cheating. So I don't want this. I want to be honest. And with this attitude, always examining your activities. Similarly, you would listen to other people's opinions in a way that would be helpful to you, not being overwhelmed, of course, by every opinion that somebody has, but listening, being able to listen to what somebody else say something, not that immediately somebody says something about me that's a little corrective of my activities and I become so self-defensive because I don't want to change anything that I'm doing. These open attitudes are part of commitment to honesty. Someone asked about what should be the meditation of a devotee attending a Ratha Yatra. Should one think of Krishna being brought back to Vrindavan? What did Prabhupada teach? So, I wanted to answer this first by saying what is not the right meditation for attending a Ratha Yatra. I read this in these stories translated about Gaurakishore Das Babaji. Described that at one time in his life, when he was living in some humble little hut, and some of his followers and people used to come every day and they were having classes. So then there was discussion about going to Ratha Yatras, and there were several Ratha Yatras coming up. So they asked him something about it, and he began to mention it. He said, yes, there's one Ratha Yatra at such and such town, and I've heard that they'll be serving Ras Rulas there, and this and that is going to be at the feast. And then he mentioned some of the other Ratha Yatras. Let me look at it. at Potamatala there's a large cart and festival, and then there's a prominent zamindar there who has a cart, and if one goes there he can get rasgullas and yogurt and flat rice. In this way, Babaji Maharaj described five or seven places where Rath Yatra was to be held. Everyone began to wonder whether he was encouraging them to attend the car festivals. So then, when the actual Rath Yatra came, the date, he came out of his hut and no one was there. He would have gone to the Rath Yatras. So instead of his holding his usual class, the usual class was not held as everyone had gone to see the chariot parades. Babaji Maharaj opened the door of his thatched cottage, came out and announced with a slight smile on his face, "Today I can save my breath, as everyone has gone. Those who are chanting Harinam with offense have given up the hearing and chanting of Hari Katha in the association of devotees. Having gone to see the Rath Yatra, they will look at the young women, the crowd of worldly people and other objects of enjoyment. They have no attraction for Hari Bhajan." So, of course, he's a very exceptional person with his emphasis on bhajan and not on preaching. But aside from that, I'm drawing out these wrong mentalities, which would be, as he points out, to think of a Rath Yatra as a place of all things, of just associating with the opposite sex and being able to enjoy very palatable food and sweets. So because those things, that kind of thing is available at the Rath Yatras, because it's so much socialization and feasting, it's not wrong. It's not that there shouldn't be people there and we shouldn't go and feast, but that's not the whole point. So so how did Prabhupada teach? Did he teach the inner meaning of Rath Yatra? This little booklet, I don't know if you, where this monthly thing that comes out in California, Daily Devotions, every day in each month they send them out, and they're little quotes from Prabhupada's books. So for the month of July, it's all about Rath Yatra. And they have one 1970 Rath Yatra lecture. So 1970, devotees were not very advanced. And yet here's Prabhupada's opening words of the Rath Yatra. First introductory, "My dear boys and girls, thank you very much. Krishna consciousness movement was started by Lord Krishna 5,000 years ago. So, when Krishna was present, once upon a time, there was a solar eclipse. At that time, Krishna, along with his elder brother Balaram," this is not in the temple, this is in San Francisco at Golden Gate Park to the crowd. "Along with his elder Balaram and his younger sister Subhadra came from Dwarka to Kurukshetra. The inhabitants of Vrindavan also came on this occasion. Because they were suffering out of too much separation from Krishna, they came to see him there. At that time, his beloved Radharani was very afflicted. She said, 'You are the same Krishna, I am the same Radharani, but the place is different, Kurukshetra. It is not Vrindavan. Therefore, I wish that you come with me to Vrindavan and let us enjoy our previous life. This is the ecstasy of the residents of Vrindavan. This festival celebrates this meeting.'" And then he goes on to tell how the deity was built, Indradumna the sculptor being asked to be alone, and so on. And then he goes back again to the importance of chanting Hare Krishna and the meaning of Jagannath. I thought that was a direct answer to the question, whether Prabhupada taught this inner meaning, and yes, he did. There's another question about Grihastha Ashram. Well, we've discussed it some, but I thought of something I wanted to say about it. The question is, in Vedic philosophy, we see that man and woman are seen as the perfect unit, cooperating with one another to cultivate one another's spiritual life to the fullest. It is somewhat disillusioning that there is as much marital breakdown within ISKCON as outside this movement. Why? I wonder, is there sometimes a destructive attitude that marriage is maya and that it is something that one resorts to if one is not strong enough to avoid it? Is marriage viewed in Vedic philosophy as a vital part of a person's growth? Certainly, so here's a description of marriage as being something to almost be ashamed of for a devotee. It's like it's advertising that he is not a good devotee. And on the other hand, something which is very suitable and progressive for renunciation and surrender to Krishna. And where do we stand? So I think that we have to try to reach the ideals of every ashram. In the sannyasa ashram, it has a very good reputation, or let's say it is very much praised as the most spiritually advanced ashram, but it doesn't always have a good reputation. Sadhus are seen as, even by religious people, as beggars, as hypocrites, and so on, because they are, some of them. Therefore, there is a degraded and inferior way to execute the ashram, and then there's a very wonderful way to execute it. So if you go to the ideals of the Grihastha ashram, they're just as ideal as the sannyasa ashram. So I think whatever ashram you're in, or we're discussing Grihastha should try to realize the ideals. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not like built in or inherent that this is an ashram where you move slow. It's the slow lane, and it's the nonsense activities are done here. But it's there was one purport I read in Italy. It was a really heavy purport chastising misbehavior in Grihastha life. And Prabhupada said a man gets married for two reasons. To satisfy his tongue by his wife's cooking, and for sex life. So, in commenting on it, I said, does this mean that Prabhupada says this has to be? And also, does it mean that Prabhupada says that this is what he wants? So almost sometimes when we hear it so heavy, you get paralyzed and you think, he's saying it has to be, and that's the way it is. It's a condemnation. But why would Prabhupada condemn the ashram, which most of his followers are in? He didn't. But there is a condemned situation, just like a condemned situation for the sannyasi. And we have to try to realize the highest aspects of Grihastha, seeing the great examples in the Vaishnava history of all these wonderful Grihasthas. And although they're extraordinary, we're reading now Chaitanya Bhagavat, and for the first time I'm beginning to understand the person of Srivasacharya, who's mentioned in the Panchatattva, Srivasadi Gaur, and who is always just a name for me. Now I'm beginning to learn about Srivasacharya and how all the wonderful, miraculous activities of Lord Chaitanya were carried on in his house. So he's a perfect devotee, but he's very much a householder. He's always dealing with his wife, and he's dealing with his children. But all those activities, there are always something sublime about them. Like when his son dies during the kirtan, and he responds in an exemplary way as a liberated person, but within the context of household life. And the other activities also. It's like one time they were having a very ecstatic kirtan, and Lord Chaitanya, he wasn't ecstatic. He said, something's wrong. I don't feel my usual ecstasy. Maybe there's somebody sinful here. So Srivasacharya looked all around his house to see if there was anybody who wasn't a bona fide devotee there. He couldn't find anybody. Then they started the kirtan again. Lord Chaitanya stopped, said, something's wrong. I can't feel the ecstasy. So then they began to feel, maybe it's us. We're the ones who are not really devotees, and he's showing us that we're sinful. But Srivasacharya, he kept looking and looking around the house, and finally he found hiding behind some boxes or something. Hiding in the house was his mother-in-law, and the author says he grabbed her by the hair and pulled her out. of curiosity, not devotion, to see what are they doing, all these wild exhibitions I want to see. So she wasn't taking part, she was hiding and looking. So there was Sri Vasacharya as a householder trying to keep the kirtan going, trying to please the Lord, get rid of his mother-in-law. Within his ashram, so you shouldn't have an inferiority complex about it. I remember it was real early, 1969 or something like that, and I had my job still in the welfare office, and another devotee, Rupanuga, he came to visit our temple, and we were sitting down in prasadam, and one of the devotees said to Rupanuga, you still have your karmi job? And Rupanuga said very, he could be very stately, and he said, I don't consider it a karmi job, he said. And that was how I felt too. It's not a karmi job. We're serving Krishna. So somebody may think like that, oh, you're a grihastha or you have a karmi job or something. But we don't have to fall into that mentality. And same with the sannyas. We don't have to fall into people's low mentality. More things anyone wants to discuss? I have more prepared things, but I'd just like to keep up the interest, whatever people are interested in. Ah, this is good. About some questions about devotee relationships. There's a couple of them. How can I become a more serious devotee and therefore overcome suffering in the form of fear and anxiety? This is based on a statement by Prabhupada that unless we're a devotee, unless we go back to Godhead, we'll have to suffer fear and anxiety in this world. So how can we do this? But Prabhupada also, I don't have the reference that the person is referring to, but Prabhupada also indicated a connection between a reduction of that kind of suffering and impersonalism when he says that one of the main reasons people turn to impersonalism is because of their bad experiences in relation to personal dealings. So it would seem that if you don't develop personal relationships and always expect the worst from people, that you can in some way mitigate your sufferings in that area. But this is not possible, that we can suffer less by not having any relationships with people. It's not the positive approach. Prabhupada sometimes called that a negative life of frustration, by which one would even go take renounced order and live in the forest. But rather, we're in our normal condition, we're social beings, and we want loving relationships. So we have to learn to develop spiritual relationships. Now we're spiritual people. We don't want to have material relationships. So the impersonal idea is that you think, well, relationships are going to mean that I'm going to be cheated, or I'll cheat somebody. So I don't want relationships. But we have to try to develop among devotees relationships where those old rules don't apply. Now this is an ideal statement, but to do it we're finding it's a slow process and sometimes painful, because we develop relationships and they are frustrating, or we seem like they're superficial, or we get cheated in some way. But what's the alternative to devotee friendships? The alternative is either friendships with non-devotees, which is not going to be suit my purpose at all. Even if I find somebody who's very apparently attractive and likable or even like-minded, but he doesn't like Krishna, then there's no substance there in that relationship except sense gratification, mental speculation, although it may be of a so-called nice level. Or another alternative is no relationships at all. But who's going to do that? Who can live as a hermit without any relationships? So this is work, and this is our fortune when we can find friends in Krishna consciousness. The question is, how to reduce suffering? So we can reduce suffering in any case by turning to Krishna, always in our life. So that even if there are disappointments in devotee relationships, we can turn to Krishna. And not be so hurt or so devastated when things don't go right in the material world or in our attempt to make friendships. There was another, connected to this, another question about devotee relationships. When we were reading about the devotee relationships in Lord Chaitanya's time, and how the devotees were so happy together serving the Lord, the question came up. Their relations were very intimate, but the relations I have with devotees, I find myself unspontaneous and calculating. I might think, I better not say something about ISKCON to this devotee because I know how he feels, or this devotee thinks like this, so I won't say that. It seems there's so much interference that we never get down to hearing and chanting together. Why is this? What is this? This is there's so many things, touchy things that we don't want to talk about that we don't get down to chanting and hearing, he says. But another way to look at it is to try to come together for these non-controversial activities of chanting and hearing together in some way or other. And then we'll be able to honor each other and either remove the barriers so that we can talk about sensitive issues, because we've come together and our differences have become softened by the spiritual vibration. Or we may feel it's not necessary to discuss the so-called sensitive or controversial issues because we're becoming satisfied by the spiritual activities. But in any case, also, it's not that all relationships with devotees are going to be the most intimate for us. But all devotees should be honored, and as much as possible, we should have some occasions to associate with devotees in the absolute plane. One more.
Just that thing about devotee relationships, it seems that a lot of the times we may feel that we're being attacked or something, or we're being criticized or whatever. But another person may feel the exact same from the person that's feeling that. And it seems like a lot of these problems are defensive.
So according to that analysis, which I can relate to as something that happens, that we all have a little paranoia, meaning that there's really not that much attack always coming, but we think it is, and the more we can be secure, then we won't be afraid of attacks, at least before they come. And we can be more generous, well situated. Even, in other words, even if the person I'm with now, even if he is thinking something, deriding me, so let him think that. But I still, it doesn't mean what I'm doing is wrong, and it doesn't mean that he's a terrible person. He can be so well situated. Well, I would stress the second, that we should try to deal with it, that due to my own mental problems, I'm a hard person to relate to for others, because I've got my own problems so much. So if I can minimize those problems, then I'll be a more agreeable person in devotee relationships. But so there's quite a kind of a grassroots activity going on among ISKCON members of doing that in different ways, getting professional counseling. But it's often very risky to do from non-devotees. And Krishna consciousness is meant to certainly deal with psychological problems, although one is supposed to be somewhat fit to come to start to practice this. Still, we have problems, and the process of bhakti yoga is meant to clear those also. If you have good faith like that, that if I can become attracted to Krishna and develop my faith in the spiritual world and so on, then I will solve my problems. And if they're so severe, then some kind of intensive care can be done, but try to do it in the association of devotees. But yes, it should be, I should try to get rid of my hang-ups. I would like to close just with the one more thing. There was a question based on the talk, the class I gave in Dublin. Says, when you spoke on the Srimad Bhagavatam verse, Satam Pasangam Mamavirya Samvido, 325-25 Bhagavatam, I wondered what real devotion and devotional service mentioned in Prabhupada's translations means. So the verse says that in the association of devotees, pure devotees, discussion of the pastimes and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is very pleasing and satisfying to the ear and the heart. By cultivating such knowledge, one gradually becomes advanced on the path of liberation, and thereafter he is freed and his attraction becomes fixed. And then here's the phrase, then real devotion and devotional service begin. That's kind of an intriguing phrase. What is this real devotion? And only now, devotional service begins. So Prabhupada has used this kind of expression before, that devotional service actually begins after liberation. And before that, there's devotional service, but it's mixed. So within this verse, if you want to look at it, you'll see there are words that describe a step-by-step to attaining real devotion. Of course, there are many analyses, like Rupa Goswami, about step-by-step to attain the highest devotional service. But in this verse, the word is used, anukramishyate, which means that they will follow in an order. If you practice chanting and hearing, then one after another, these steps will come. And the one is Apavarga. It says, Tajjoshanat Asu Apavarga Vartmani Shradharatir Bhakti Anukramishate. You'll become liberated from material life. You'll develop Shraddha. This is a very full Shraddha, not the preliminary thing, but complete conviction in Krishna consciousness. And then Rati, and then taste. So in simple, the simple meaning is that the real devotional service means pure devotional service, not mixed. And in this in Kapila's teachings, he teaches about mixed devotional service. He says, devotional service by a person who is envious, proud, violent, and angry, and who is a separatist, is in the mode of darkness. The worship of the deities in the temple by a separatist with a motive for material enjoyment, fame, and opulence is devotion in the mode of passion. When a devotee worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead and offers the results of his activities in order to free himself from the inebrieties of fruitive activities, his devotion is in the mode of goodness. So there's mixed devotional service. And we can say real devotion and devotional service begin when you're beyond these. Another way to analyze it is mechanical and spontaneous. When we just do it, going through the motion, it's devotional service, but when you do it because you love to do it, then real devotional service begins. All right. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.